Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at the world of animals today. It's an amazing world. And we're going to be talking about the physics behind how they survive. And we'll get that from our interview with our two guests. Our guests are the authors of a new book. It's called Furry Logic, The Physics of Animal Life. And joining us from the UK, first Mateen Durrani, who is the editor of the international magazine Physics World. Mateen Durrani, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I tell you what, it's great to have you with us. Liz Callagher, we're working to get her on right now. She's the editor of Environmental Research Web. It's a leading news research on environmental issues, and I'm going to talk to our listeners for a minute. You may have some questions about particular animal behavior and maybe the physics behind it. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Liz Callagher, welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you with us today. This is such an interesting and fun book to read. I have to tell you, I was watching on regular TV a movie, Julie and Julia. You may have seen it. Meryl Streep played Julia Child. And as I was watching Meryl Streep's amazing performance of Julia Child talking, I thought, you know what? My guest today, who I'm going to have on, write a little bit like Julia Child writes and speaks, because you do it in such an inviting way, and you make us, you draw us in, and there's a lot of humor, and even the subtitles within chapters, I found a whole lot of fun, and so it made such an enjoyable adventure for me to read about the life of animals and the physics behind what they do. So it was really a lot of fun. I'm just going to start by talking about that. And I can see what might have prompted you to write this book, but it must have been a whole lot of work to put it together, Liz Callagher.
Well, it was a whole lot of work, but as you said, it was also a whole lot of fun, which was great. Animals are so fascinating, and it was great to get a chance to talk to some of the researchers who've dedicated their lives to finding out more about them. They were all really fun people to talk to.
Yeah, I would bet they were a lot of fun to talk to. And that was another thing. You kind of put a human side, I think, a very human side on the researchers and how they, you know, decide to come up with some of the research that they do, which is that part of it was really interesting to me as well. You talk about how physics is an easier way to study behavior than biology. And Mateen, why is that the case?
Well, I think if you ever think about doing a physics experiment, most people think about doing something in a laboratory where you've got a nice warm room, it's comfortable, you've got everything under your control. If you want to turn the temperature, you can just dial a little button to turn it up. Out in the wild where animals live, excuse me, it's very difficult to study animals. There are all sorts of different types. There's all sorts of variety. Trying to find the animals can sometimes be very, very difficult. And as soon as you study them in the wild, you could be putting them off or affecting how their natural habitat is. So it's very difficult, I'd say, compared to physics.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you on that one. I loved how you divided your chapters up. You have heat and forces and fluids and sounds and electricity and magnetism, and you have light, and talk about how all those things factor in to the behavior of these animals. And behavior comes down to just a couple of things, as you point out.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of the book is, you know, we decided to, I mean, all the animals in the world, there is such a great variety, and to try and draw some sort of common themes, we divided the book, as you say, into looking at different subjects, how sound affects animals, how they use light or heat, And we found it was an interesting way, and in furry logic, we don't think there's been a book that's been like that before. So we hope readers, listeners out there, you know, pick up on that. And, you know, we found it absolutely fascinating. I mean, there were so many examples that we've got up our sleeve. There was no shortage of material for the book. Really, there was no shortage at all.
Well, I can believe that as well. And I want to remind as we listen in that we're talking with our two authors today. As you're in London?
In England. We're both based in Bristol in the UK.
In the UK. So just so folks know that. Well, let's talk about some of the chapters themselves. And I was struck right off the bat in your heat chapters, your heat chapter, I should say, that animals trap a lot of moisture in their hair and they need to get rid of it. Don't they?
Yeah, that's absolutely one of my favorite stories, in the book, because there was a guy in Georgia Institute of Technology, and he was fascinated by his dog. You know, how much water do they use? How much water do they soak when you imagine a dog running into the river? How much water does it trap under its fur? And he was fascinated by that and decided to do some experiments. And you know, if you're a dog, you don't want to get cold. And evaporation, anyone who steps out of a shower on a cold day knows how cold it can be if you let water evaporate off. And no dog's going to wait for that water to evaporate. So they obviously shake it off. And it's a much more energy-efficient process. And the research estimates it's probably about 5,000 times less energy to shake it off than it is to wait for it to dry off. And, of course, that's not much fun if the water goes over you, but it's going to be life or death for the dog if it stays cold, because hypothermia can be a real problem for animals.
Well, and I think you were talking about rats at one point, Liz, and I think there was like 5% of the body weight of the rat was taken up with water when it was all wet, or am I just confusing?
No, that's right. They looked at a range of different animal sizes, and there are actually videos available online. I think we thought that the mouse and the rat were definitely the cutest when they were shaking themselves dry.
I can believe that. And I like the fact, or I was interested in the fact, that they all these furry animals shake in pretty much the same way, do they not?
Yeah, they all have this motion called, and people might remember at school days, something called simple harmonic motion. And it's basically a kind of back and forth motion like a pendulum. And the people who studied it found that all animals behave in pretty much the same way. The big difference is the speed at which the animal shakes. And the brown bear was the slowest. I think it was four shakes a second. And the little rats were really, really fast. They were the cutest. They went really, really quickly. But they all follow the same principles of physics. And that to me was, you know, really interesting that nature has evolved in that way, that all animals do it in kind of the same way.
Yeah, and in the heat chapter, I was also interested in how animals have to regulate their body, like a mosquito has to regulate its body temperature, if I'm not mistaken, by expelling, as it's drawing your blood, it's also expelling some things to keep its temperature constant.
Yeah, there's some species of mosquito, and it's always the female mosquitoes that bite us. And for the mosquito, excuse me, it's very dangerous because some of them, when they suck your blood, they can treble in body weight. And having that much of hot blood inside a mosquito is very, very dangerous. You can imagine that it's like drinking 100 liters of soup. You know, you're going to get hot. So to cool off, some mosquitoes expel a droplet of blood and water, and that helps them cool off through evaporation.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And, you know, we've known about this for years, but scientists have studied it with heat imaging cameras, and they can study second by second to watch the animal cool off as the droplet evaporates. Really, really fascinating, and also quite amazing to think that this happens. And we've only discovered that, the exact mechanism, in the last few years.
Well, I was just amazed at the length to which researchers would go across a whole variety of animals to actually record and come up with answers to the questions of why they do the things that they do. I'm going to move ahead just to forces for a minute, just because I thought that was a lot of fun too. And since mosquitoes reminded me of when you're talking about force, a mosquito dodging raindrops, Liz, was... you used an example of a raindrop hitting a mosquito and the weight of the raindrop versus the weight of the mosquito would be the akin to us being struck by, what, a truck or something going fairly fast?
That's right. It's equivalent to a human being hit by a 5-ton truck, which is obviously bad. But the mosquitoes use a really cunning physics trick. So they kind of hang on to the raindrop if it hits them when they're flying. And by riding along with it, they're able to kind of ride the punch and increase the time of the impact, which actually reduces the force so they can survive. That falls apart if they're on a leaf or on the ground. They can't then move along and stick to the raindrop, and then it's game over.
Yeah.
But if they're flying, physics will save them.
Kind of good for us that particular mosquito that was too close to the ground is probably not going to be with us any longer. But I loved how they actually grab a hold of a raindrop and just ride it.
It's amazing, isn't it? And there's actually, the researcher is looking at that as a way of perhaps creating a pesticide-free mosquito destroyer by having tiny droplets of a waxy substance that will stick to them that could disrupt the way they fly rather than using chemicals.
You know, and that's one of the really interesting, you know, just on the face of it, you look at some of this research and say, why in the world would anybody bother? But there are practical reasons that humans could use what they learn from the physics of these animals to create things that would be helpful to mankind in one way or another.
In fact, the guy who did... Go on.
Oh, sorry.
The guy who did the work, David Hu at Georgia Institute of Technology, he is very interesting. Well, there was one senator, I can't remember his name, you know, really criticized him for this ridiculous work that he was doing on animals. And, of course, he would say, you know, there's some fantastic physics that you can teach to people and really get them interested in how the world of physics works through animals.
Well, I think, you know, in that same chapter you talk about forces, geckos. I spent a year teaching at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad, and I have geckos on my wall all the time, and I just assumed that there was some very sticky substance on their feet that allowed them to move around. But that's not entirely the case, is it?
No, that's right. They actually use van der Waals forces, which are the really tiny forces you get if atoms are up very close to each other, just because the electrons are moving. So you've got a constantly changing electric field, so they'll attract and repel. And the geckos have huge surface area on their feet because they have lots and lots of tiny hairs that they can get up really close to the surface. And just by adding up all those tiny forces, they can get enough to support. I think they can support their body weight with just one foot. So if they start falling and they can catch on with one foot, then they can save themselves.
And on the practical, well, I don't know if it's practical or not, but on the other side of it, there's been some research on how to try and develop a Spider-Man type issue so that people can kind of do what the geckos do. Hasn't worked too well yet.
No, that's right. Interestingly, people looking at that, some people have tried to replicate the hairs and stick to the wall that way, or a glass panel. But other people are looking, the geckos also have very fleshy folds on their feet. So other people are looking at replicating those fleshy folds as a way of making.
It's really, really fascinating to me. Talking today with the authors of Furry Logic, The Physics of Animal Life. And our guests, Mateen Durrani and Liz Callagher, talking with us from the UK. Mateen is editor of the international magazine Physics World, has a PhD in polymer physics. Liz Callagher, PhD in material science, and is the editor of Environmental Research Web, a leading news resource on environmental issues. Questions for them. Do you have a question about why animals behave the way they do and maybe how physics can play a part? I hope you'll join us. Give a call at 1-800 642-1234. You can email us. The email address is talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45 today, we'll talk with one of the authors of a new book that can help those with loved ones who suffer from Alzheimer's disease keep love alive as memories fade. That's at 11:45. Right now, taking a look at the book Furry Logic, The Physics of Animal Life, with our two guests, Mateen Durrani and Liz Callagher, who are the authors of the book. Again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. A listener emailed to ask if worms have sensory organs for magnetism. You guys know anything about that?
Wow, that's a good question. I don't know specifically about worms, but we do know for definite that turtles do, and we believe that pigeons do, and even some bacteria.
I was really interested in your chapter on electricity and magnetism. You looked at eels, for example, which to me, just the fact that eels can generate electricity was amazing. You might talk about that and how they kill their prey.
Yeah, the electric eel, to be honest, that was one of the favorite animals I had in the book. And I we've known about these animals for centuries, but they inspired some of the very earliest experiments into electricity. People were fascinated by what these animals were and what on earth was this stuff doing. It was before people knew really what electricity was. And we now know that they can create voltages of up to 9,000 volts. 900 volts, very high, and they do this to stun prey and eat them. But it's only in the last couple of years that we really know the proper mechanism, and people have found that the way the electric eel kills its prey, it stuns it very much like a police taser by firing a volley of very high voltage bursts in succession, and that makes the prey, it makes its muscles contract so tightly it can't move. And then the animal can eat the prey. But, you know, people like Charles Darwin were so intrigued by electric eels that he wondered how nature could have created this incredible animal. And in his book, On the Origin of the Species, apparently he had them in a separate chapter at the back, kind of unexplained animals, that he couldn't work out why nature would have given an animal that power. But we're kind of a bit closer to knowing why these days.
And I think loggerhead turtles are an interesting part of that chapter as well. It's a really fascinating story about the travels that they take, I think somewhere around 10,000 miles, and then return to Liz, to their where they were born.
Yes, it's amazing. And this was one of my favorite stories. I think it's fascinating that when they're born, they're just 2 inches long, these hatchlings, and weirdly the safest place for them to be is right in the middle of the open ocean, because the birds and the fish that swoop down on them when they're near the beach don't head that far out into the sea.
So they got to get about 30 miles out, I think you said.
That's right, yep. And then they go on a giant loop. Ken Lohman, who was studying these turtles, studies them in Florida. So they head out from the East Florida coast, pick up the Gulf Stream, loop round to Northern Europe, head down to Africa and back to Central America, and then they stay there. Then by that time they're kind of 2 foot long, so the only thing big enough to eat them is a shark, so they're a bit safer and they can come back to the coast, and they hang out there and eat until they're about 20, and then they're ready to breed, and then they head back to the very beach where they were hatched to start with.
And what do they use?
Well, they use magnetism, which they proved by putting hatchlings in a tank and tethering them. And then they had coils of electric wire around the tank, and they changed the current in the coil to replicate magnetic fields in different places on Earth. And if they made the field like the one off Florida, the turtles would head east as if they were heading out into the sea. But if they reversed the current and changed that field, they'd head in the opposite direction. So they know that's how they do it. They don't quite know, well, they know that's what they do. but they're not sure how they're doing it. They could contain tiny particles of magnetite, which is an iron oxide, so that could be in their bodies and line up with the magnetic field and press on nerve cells. But Ken put a turtle in an MRI scanner at his local hospital and couldn't find any of these particles, but that could be because they're too small. Or it could be they're using pigments in the back of their eyeballs called cryptochromes, which react slightly differently if there's a different magnetic field. So they could see colours or lights on their normal vision field that shows them which way's north.
It's amazing. And in the at the end of the chapter, with the eels, we have an electricity example and a magnetism example with loggerhead turtles. And you say at the end of the chapter, electricity and magnetism are two heads of the same coin. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you go back to the days of Michael Faraday, when he discovered how to make a motor, you know, you can make a motor by sending electric current down a wire and it moves. And similarly, a dynamo, you can send a current and you can get movement. So they're kind of two sides of the same thing. In fact, physicists say that they eventually managed to unify the two forces into something called electromagnetism. Two sides of the same coin, and fascinating that animals can exploit that bit of physics.
No, absolutely. Tom in Cedarburg has a question for you. Tom, hi, thank you for calling.
Thanks for having me. I have two quick questions. My first one is I see flying squirrels in the backyard once in a while, and I was wondering what your guests had to say about them and how they do what they do. And my second question is kind of tags along with the electric eel. I was wondering about the manta rays, from the small ones to the big ones with that electric tail, how they, you know, do that.
Okay, let's see.
Well,
go ahead. I'm sorry, Liz. Go ahead.
My fault. Hi, Tom. I'll take the flying squirrels question. Flying squirrels, they don't actually fly. They technically glide because they don't create lift, the force that pushes them upwards. So they glide and gradually descend. So they use their the membranes between their, I guess, effectively their hands and their feet to soar like a glider. But unlike animals that, say, flap their wings, they don't create a force forwards. So that's what they do.
Yeah.
They do a number of...
And, Mateen, what about the manta rays?
Do you know what? I feel like in an exam question at school, I have no idea what the answer to that is. That's going to be in furry logic too. If the guy there can help me write the second book, we'll more than happy to help. Put that in volume two.
Well, you know, the whole business about flying in flight, it was really, you address that in your book. And one of the examples that you talk, one of the animals you talk about is the bumblebee and bees in general. In some way, you know, you look at a bee and their wingspan doesn't seem to be big enough for them to fly, and yet they do.
That's right. This is something that had scientists puzzled for a while, and it turned out the bees were doing something completely new that actually now people are looking to copy to make tiny drones and micro air vehicles. So it turns out if you use the sort of aerodynamics we developed for planes that have long fixed wings, the bee shouldn't be able to fly. But actually these bees, they create a swirl of air above the front of their wings, and then they send that out towards the tip of their wings. And in doing that, that keeps the swirl of air in place, whereas normally that swirl might detach from the wing, which would make the bee stall, in the same way that if you were flying a toy plane and you put its nose up too fast, it would crash to the ground. That's what happens when the air detaches. But because the bee sends a vortex out in a spiral at 90 degrees to the direction it's flying, it keeps it in place and it gives it 70% of its lift.
Yeah,
which is amazing.
It's just absolutely amazing. Tom, again, thank you for calling. Connie in Frankfort, Michigan, it's your turn. Hi, Connie.
Hi, it's Camille.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I wondered if your guests could address the issue of the interference of sonar for ocean mammals, because I've been hearing a bit about the submarines and ships and other things that interfere with them so much that they can't find each other.
Mateen?
Yeah.
Or Liz, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's definitely something that needs to be looked at. The ocean's a really, really noisy place because sound travels 5 times further in water than in air, and it doesn't, it goes faster as well. So the ocean's very noisy, and any extra noise we're adding could potentially disrupt animals the way that they're behaving down there. And I know that there's been studies looking at building wind turbine platforms as well in the ocean for offshore turbines, and you have to do that very carefully because the noise when you're driving the piles to make those can also upset porpoises.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, thank you very much, Camille. Christina in Glenwood City, it's your turn. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. Now, I observe the birds, a variety of birds at my feeders every day, and I've noticed that English sparrows have done very well in the U.S., and their pattern of behavior seems to be different than the other birds. They seem as though they are connected by some kind of a mesh energy field because they move together, I mean, as if they're part of a grouping. Is there any truth to that, or do you have any information about this kind of behavior?
Well, I think, hi there. I think collective behavior in animals, where the animals act in unison, is very common. I mean, if you ever think of birds migrating, they go in big flocks, and kind of they all know where each other is. Somehow they stay just that right distance apart from each other to fly in a big formation. And, of course, we've seen things like ants work cooperatively to build nests, and there's lots of other examples. Penguins huddle together to stay warm. So, there could definitely be something in how they behave collectively, groups of animals, yeah, for sure.
And with birds, I think I remember a guest talking about how birds actually, even though they're flying in a big bunch like those English sparrows, they're paying attention to the person, the bird on their right and on their left, and they have on a peripheral vision to watch the wingspan or the wings of those birds, and they move kind of as one in that fashion. And
that's right, because aerodynamically, if they stay a certain wingspan away from the bird next to them, because there are also swirls of air coming off the end of those wings, they can pick that up, and it helps them fly more easily.
Yeah, and that's why, they use physics in a way. Canada geese would be a good example, but you see them flying, and they're always flying and are pretty much always flying in a V pattern, especially if they're going some long distance. And so they're taking advantage, are they not, Mateen, of physics in some fashion?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they must be. Yeah, that stands to reason. In fact, as I said before, there were so many animals that this idea of how they use physics is something that very few people are starting to realize, which is one of the reasons why we put the book together, about how many animals use physics. The question always is that this comes onto is, do they actually know the physics? The good example is of someone doing skateboarding. A skateboarder can do all sorts of fantastic moves that use lots of complex physics, but you wouldn't necessarily say that skateboarder knows the laws and the rules. So to me, what's interesting is, do the animals know what they're doing, or do they just kind of learn a sort of a physics that works for them? That, to me, is what I find really interesting, almost like a philosophical question.
Yeah, and or born with it. I mean, many of them must be kind of born with it. You take a turtle that just runs out to the sea and goes as far as it can, and like, what is it, 1 in 4,000 make it? They don't get aren't eaten up, I think you point out. But
The other great example in the book is about the archerfish, which is a fish that lives in the sort of tropics in the East Asia. And it's wonderful. It sits just below the surface of the water, and it can spit a jet of water at an animal, a fly, let's say, sitting on a leaf. And it manages to do that almost perfectly every time. So it fires through the water, surface of the water, hits the animal drops down and gets to eat it. And the question is, does it learn that or does it do it from birth? And there's one really interesting experiment in the book where somebody managed to collect a load of archer fish, grew them, and with one fish, he managed to see that the fish managed to spit and do it first time. But the problem was, for him, you can't really draw conclusions in science just from one data point. And then his grant money ran out, and he didn't have any money left to do any more studies, so we don't quite know the answer to that one. But the archer fish, and it's fascinating to watch them spit, incredible. And the question is, do they do that from birth, or do they learn it? And the answer seems to be, they intuitively do it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Have you guys read The Secret Life of Lobsters by Trevor Corson? It's a fascinating book. I interviewed him a few years back. You should take a look at it. But I was thinking about his book as I read your chapter on sounds when you were talking about forget the lobster you were talking about.
Oh, is it the spiny California lobster?
Talk about that.
Yeah, so they're amazing. A lot of animals, like insects, make a noise by rubbing something hard against something bumpy. Mm-hmm. But these lobsters molt every few months, which means they haven't got any hard surfaces. But they also don't have claws, these spiny lobsters. They have spiny antennae. Mm-hmm. So when they've molted and they're very soft, they're in trouble because they can't protect themselves that well. So what they do is make a really, really loud noise. But because they haven't got hard surfaces, they actually play the violin. They use something soft and something smooth. So they have a soft end on the end of their antennae. And they rub that against a smooth plate beneath their eye. And then you get stick and slip friction. So it slips and then it sticks. And every time it sticks, you get a noise. And unlike a violin, which is designed to make a beautiful noise as the bow sticks and slips on the string, the lobster actually makes a horrible, horrible noise. And that sometimes is enough to make whatever's picked up, drop it and leave.
Absolutely amazing. And you do point out that, you know, the lobster we buy at the market and take and put in boiling water isn't really screaming when you put it in the boiling water. What's happening there, Mateen?
I think what it is the steam escaping through cracks in the surface. So it's not making a noise. People think it's because it's squealing and it's dying. We're not sure. We don't think it's that. I think it's the steam escaping through cracks in the bone. Yeah.
So there you go. Mars on Facebook asks if researchers know why dogs circle before they lay down. Is this biological or is physics somehow involved in that?
Well, I mean, the whole physics of how and science of how people, animals sleep and how they manage to do that, that's something we didn't touch on in the book. Liz, do you know the answer?
I think that one's probably biological. I think it's something left over from when you're kind of clearing yourself a nice little nest in the grass. But it would be interesting to find out.
Yeah, it would be. I want to go back to fluids a little bit because dogs reminded me of cats, and I read your part about cats drinking, and I watched Coco, one of my two cats, who always jumps up on the bathroom sink when I am getting ready for bed, and I turn on the water a little bit, and Coco laps up some water. And it looks to me like, and this is kind of not very scientific, like it takes about, Coco takes about, 3 or 4 laps in a second.
Yeah, I think you should be a scientist. That's probably about right. I mean, the way the cat drinks, I mean, when we need to drink, we just grab a glass of water and drink. But animals have to use their own bodies to get the liquid inside their mouths. And interesting, the first ever kind of study of cats drinking was a Hollywood short film in 1940 that won an Oscar for the best short film. And it used stroboscopic photography to kind of film at high speed how a cat drinks. But that was only about 9 or 10 seconds of footage. And we had to wait until 2008 when a guy at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Roman Stocker, decided to film his cat, Cutter, drinking. at high speed. And if you slow the film down, the cat kind of has a three-stage process. It first sticks its tongue out onto the surface of the water. It doesn't go into the water, just on the surface. And then it curls the tip up, lifts a column of fluid up, and then it kind of snaps that into its mouth and then repeats that exercise, as you say, three, four, five times a second until it has enough liquid in its mouth. And then it drinks that, and then it repeats the exercise. So we kind of know how cats drink, which is really interesting. It's very elegant, like a cat does it very elegantly, but dogs are really messy drinkers. They kind of ladle, not lap.
Yeah, that's a very good way to describe it. Oh, man. And I mentioned at the beginning of the program, I want to bring this in, but peacocks, you know, we're talking about sounds here once more, and I mentioned we were going to mention peacocks, male peacocks, and I've watched one at our local zoo, a male, parade around and vibrate its tail.
Yeah, because we all know how loud peacocks are. The males are the beautiful peacocks with the beautiful green-blue feathers, and they make a heck of a racket if you hear them really loud. But there's also a sound that they make by shivering their tail feathers that we can't hear. It's called infrasound, and it's below human hearing, below 20 hertz. So we can't hear it, but you can pick it up with special equipment. And people who've studied peacocks in zoos and matched the sounds with video footage realize that it's called infrasound, and it attracts the peahens, the women. They get attracted to these very, very low sounds. Someone likened it to a very deep Barry Fry with a very deep voice, kind of turns them on.
And one area we haven't covered, and I want to do it just in the last minute or so, is light. And there's some really interesting, a lot of interesting examples in there, but the Tunisian ants and how they use light in terms of finding out where they are and where to go, it was interesting to me, Liz.
Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting how many amateur scientists became fascinated by ants. So back in the 19th century, I believe, a doctor who was a Swiss doctor but was living in Tunisia, he went out in the afternoons when he wasn't seeing patients and examined the ants. But it wasn't till about 100 years later, after some scientists had also studied bees, that we finally worked out how they were finding their way back home again. And what they actually do, they're using the light, but they're not using the sun directly as a marker. They're using the pattern of polarized light in the sky. So they can, even if the sun's not out, they can still find their way home.
I tell you what, it's amazing. And on that note, we have to close, but I'm a professor in the Department of Life Sciences Communication as well as a radio host, and so science communication is what we teach, and I'm certainly going to be sharing my book with our students, your book with our students, and because it's an inspiring way to talk about science and make it fun, and you really learn a whole lot while you're reading it. And I want to thank you both for taking time to be with me today and with us today to talk about your book, Furry Logic. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. It's been great having you on.
Ah, it's been wonderful. Mateen Durrani, editor of the international magazine Physics World, a PhD in polymer physics. Liz Callagher, a PhD in material science, editor of Environmental Research Web, a leading news resource on environmental issues. And if you want to read an entertaining book, Furry Logic is one you should pick up. Another book you may be interested in has to do with Alzheimer's and keeping love alive as memories fade. And we'll talk about that next here on the Ideas Network.